Hello friends, and welcome to this video on what it means to take refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I'm super pleased to have my friend and colleague, Lopa Nyudren Wangmo, back again to explain this super, super important, like, gateway into Buddhist practice. Also, you're invited to a very special opportunity. Lopa Nyudren Wangmo is going to offer a refuge ceremony live online to whoever wants it. So if you're interested, go ahead and find the link to register for that in the notes below. We're gonna see who wants to come, see what time works for everybody, and then schedule something. You can also find some book recommendations in the show notes and a longer video that Lopa Nyudren Wangmo did on refuge on her channel, as well as links to her other works like books and her foundation. This, by the way, is part one of three teachings on refuge, what changes when you take refuge, and how to prepare to take refuge, so please stay tuned for the other two. Finally, I just want to make it clear that you don't have to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in order to benefit from the practices of Buddhism, like meditation, reflecting on impermanence, etc. But this is the traditional way to kind of enter the gate into Dharma practice. Thank you so much, Lopanla, for joining me again to talk about refuge. This is such an important part of the Buddhist path, really, and I'm delighted to have not only someone who can talk about it, but someone who can actually offer refuge if people are interested. So thank you so much for this conversation today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here again. This is great. And it's one of my favorite topics.
Mine too. So when I actually was interested in taking refuge, I started out in the Theravadan tradition and I had been getting into Buddhism. I was in college. I was very enthusiastic. And I asked my teacher in the Thai tradition, Ajahn Ken at Wat Buddhawas, wonderful, wonderful place, wonderful being. I asked him, how do I become a Buddhist? And he said, why do you need to be a Buddhist? And it really made me think, and I think it was a great answer for me at that time coming out of Christianity. So I think I want to ask the question to you now, what is refuge and why is it important?
Well, you don't need to be a Buddhist. That's first and foremost, you know, this is something key. So that's a complicated question of, you know, refuge technically means you're going, you're seeking refuge in English, right? You're seeking refuge from something. So what are we seeking refuge from? And this is this idea of suffering, pain, and so forth that comes forth, a dukna in Tibetan, dukkha in Pali, that addresses the unsatisfactoriness of life. And the main point here is about impermanence and changeability phenomena all the time. You're doing what you think you need to do to be happy. You're trying to avoid being unhappy, and yet you can't escape it. Things are changing all the time. So there's hurt, you know, there's at the very minimum, it's disappointing. Because there's no, especially when you're young, you think, if I only got the right relationship, you know, and I can picture myself in that cozy little house with that cozy little person. That's a woman's kind of vision, you know, whatever. But maybe if you're like really into sex, you know, if I really could just have sex all the time, I'd be really happy. Or maybe you like cars. If I had that special car, I'd be satisfied. But the truth is, even, yes, you'll feel good the first time for a few minutes or days or even years. But ultimately, everything comes to an end. And so, and that sounds like kind of a bummer, but actually embracing this reality and facing up, you know, getting out of denial. You could see this even in the COVID pandemic, right? How many people you'll encounter in the media and so forth all along have been in denial that, you know, we're in a pandemic and that hundreds of thousands of people have died. Yeah. They can't, maybe they're really secretly sensitive, or maybe they're totally on the other extreme, very insensitive. But there's this pushing away of the actual facts of a situation. And facing facts is not a gloomy thing. It's a realistic thing, and it really helps in life. And I was a insufferable idealist when I was young. And there's so much painful in that, having utopian ideas about the future, maybe because I was raised on Beatles music and Star Trek, the original series, you know, where things were going to get better in the future and come to some beautiful place. It was really harsh when somebody said to me, I was in some Buddhist study group, I must have gotten that far, like, the situation is completely hopeless. That Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche said that in some talk. So it's ultimately, it is, it's never going to be what you think it's going to be. And ultimately, we're all going to pass away from this life, right? And it's weird, but embracing and facing that and finding what is transcendent, what is, I won't use the word eternal, they don't like that in Dharma, but, you know, what never dies? What is the wisdom? What is the compassion? And there is something. It's not a thing, you know, it's subtle. They're taught by the Buddha. This is the Buddha's way, is we find the what is beyond, you know, what is beyond this samsara, cyclic existence going around again and again through unsatisfactory lives. So refuge then addresses this. What's the best refuge? It's someone who tell you the truth. The Buddha spoke honestly about the nature of things and didn't pull any punches, so to speak. He was really frank with people. And that's not so, when you're a type of person who's tired of being lied to with fancy stories and fairy tales, it's really great to have the Buddha tell you the truth. And one translation of Dharma, his teachings, is simply truth. So the triple gems is what you're going to in for refuge. And that is the Buddha, the Buddha Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. And then the Sangha, your friends, your companions along the path to awakening. So that's what we're going for, is awakening, tuning into what is beyond this changeability. And so that's why the right person, you know, who feels it, who may have a connection there. And sometimes, I want to say this clear, sometimes it's not an intellectual thing like that, a philosophical, this sounds kind of philosophical, and there's a kind of person that connects with that. But there's also the kind of person who always has a Buddha statue in their garden. And they just feel, when they see a picture of the Buddha, they feel relaxed. Something relaxes inside. You know, they see a monk or a nun or a lama and so forth. They feel an inherent connection there. And that comes from, in our point of view, kind of past life contact with these things. So Om Mani Padme Hum is a mantra of compassion. And some people would hear that, it sounds like mumble, mumble, mumble. But somebody else who'd had encounter consciousness had been touched by that mantra that's in their childhood and the previous life, you know, so forth. They hear Om Mani Padme Hum, and it's like, that's me. That's what whatever that is, I want some. Or they see the Dalai Lama or the late Thich Nhat Hanh or Pema Chidren. These are famous Buddhist teachers, you know. And there's just like, it's so inspiring. You think, whatever it is they have, I want that. That's the kind of feeling. For those of us who are convert Buddhists, you know, from Western cultures, or there's actually a lot of other religions in Asia, you know, this is the kind of, there's some kind of personal calling. That's another way. Art and deep stirring within. So, and then there's people who read a lot of books and they decide what philosophy is the most profound one in this world. And they come to Dharma from that. But a lot of people, you know, I thought it was very profound. A friend of mine said, not too many people come to Dharma on a winning streak. Oh, man. And I thought, maybe, you know, Dr. Claire, I don't know, maybe you came on a winning streak into your, you might came from a studies point of view and discovered it that way. I don't know, but I didn't. I had a lot of unhappiness, a depression and anxiety and so forth, and the answers were unsatisfactory. So It's okay to be a troubled person and come to Dharma for that reason also. Refuge, finding refuge finally under the sheltering tree of the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha.
I love that image, and the image of the tree is so important in Buddhism, what Buddha became enlightened under. I'm wondering, could you just kind of, you know, you ended with that beautiful image of refuge. Could you explain what does like that sense of refuge actually mean in Buddhism? Because I feel like often people think of refuge and they think of like someone's going to protect me, but my experience with refuge has been much more profound than that.
Why don't you say what experience was more profound than that for you?
I think for me, as I like age as a Buddhist, so to speak, my understanding of refuge now, I think when I first took it, it was like, oh, this is a gate into something. And it was. But I think now I understand refuge as this profound confidence that no matter what happens in this lifetime, I will be okay. Not because I won't be, you know, not because I won't die, not because I won't get COVID or something, but because I have something toward which I can orient my attention and my focus. And I just have this confidence that that's going to draw me through into a good next lifetime too.
I think that's really profound. You know, there's a okayness. And when you see, usually people have met up or at least seen images on the internet of people that it can be kind of shocking coming from an environment, say your family of origin, where people flip out over everything that happens, you know, and then you see somebody who doesn't flip out. It's almost, or you counter a situation. You know, I remember, for example, one time I was driving to the hospital with one of my lamas, my teachers in the Tibetan system. And one of his close relatives was in the hospital. And it was very, very serious and scary. And I was all in my thoughts, well, we're going to get there to the hospital. And what's going to happen? And, you know, we're like, we have to take blah, 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 blah. And I'm, you know, all squinched down and all I could, and I could feel my Rinpoche in the seat next to me. And all of a sudden he said, wow, look at that. And he was looking at birds. And I thought, this is not normal. You know? It's not normal. So we have a chance under the guidance. And it's also the Buddha sort of represents our teachers in this life. There's all different kinds of levels. There's the inner Buddha. And then there's the outer Buddha as kind of the representative of Buddha in our lives. It's our teacher or teachers. And so that kind of thing that breaks through your habitual tendencies of how you function in the world. You know, mine was, you know, anxiety and trying to manage situations and so forth. That he's got to, you know, replace the operating system of his computer with something completely different, you know, that involves space somehow. And so he was just... it was amazing. So little things like that you learn from being around people in real life. So I recommend that to people. You didn't ask, but I recommend beyond the internet contact if you can, if you're not too remote, with real people. So what does it mean? So there's, you know, yes, there's outer, the Buddha can represent your teacher. The Buddha can represent then later on, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, the teacher, and Tantric Buddhism. You're taking refuge in your own Buddha nature. I think you've discussed that elsewhere with people. You know, your own latent, awakened, fundamental nature, which is beyond all this cogitation, all this emotionality, this always even, spacious, pure. And that becomes the, as time goes on in particular, that you may visualize in front of you as you take refuge. And we tend to do that at least once a day in our tradition, Tibetan tradition. We are touching base. We're aware that this is a reflection. We're a Buddha figure in front, maybe a Tara, Shakyamuni Buddha, Guru Rinpoche, Amitabha Buddha, is representing our potential for awakening. So it's, it gets more and more profound. That's another thing about Buddhism that's so beautiful, is that the law, it never gets boring. You can go deeper and deeper and deeper. It's not just one thing all the time, you know. So, but it's not for everyone. And I would like to, is it okay if I talk a little bit about what people are really committing to when they, what is going to for refuge, and what are they, what does it entail? What kind of vow, you know? I was thinking, because this is where the metal, you know, you and I talked privately before, like people can think, oh, I like peace, I like kindness. And as we just, all these things that we just spoke about, way beyond peace and kindness. Peace and kindness and morality are part of every religion, right? But these qualities we just discussed are different and a little shocking. So you have to decide, this is the way I'm going. I'm going to face the truth. And like that. So when you take refuge, there's actually, in the Tibetan tradition anyway, and I think in most Buddhist traditions, a ceremony, kind of like a coming-of-age ceremony. And this may be done for a baby. If you're from a Buddhist culture with Buddhist parents, you may not even remember ever doing this, or, you know, or maybe it's just assumed. But for us who are converts, so to speak, there is a ceremony, and you're making a commitment. Now, you may have think, your mind may immediately go, if you've been involved with around Dharma activities, to, oh, I'm making a commitment to certain rules. And you can make a commitment to certain rules if you want to. Sometimes those vows are given at the refuge ceremony, or sometimes in a different ceremony, depending on your tradition. You can take a vow against intoxicants, against lying, against killing. Well, again, you have to take a vow against killing. But anyway, there's a series of vows. There's like five lay vows or Genyan vows, Padamoksha in Sanskrit, that you can take. That's something you do intentionally. And they, in the Tibetan tradition, one part of their vows, they aren't precepts, meaning that they are flexible. If you take one of those vows, and you don't have to, they're in. You keep it or you break it, and when you break it, it's over. So it's a practice, keeping a vow, to really not steal, to not take what not is not given. If you're going to do that throughout your life, means if there's a bar of soap, you know, in the shower, and it's not yours, you would go ask before you would use that bar of soap. So that's a real intentional practice, and it's not required. But what is required, in the right within the ceremony that's done in the Nyingma school, and I think all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, probably similar to Mahayana schools, is you have to not intentionally kill anything. So this is by taking refuge, you're doing away with insecticide in your household. You know, and you are doing away with mouse traps. So that's a big, big commitment. So instead of, you're blocking entrance to your house by the pests instead of like that. So intentionally, not intentionally harming. Of course, you're going to, it's not an, there's other Dharmic religions where you are looking everywhere you walk for insects and, you know, like going way, way out of your way not to harm any sentient being. And that is, Buddhism isn't generally like that. It's basically watching the consciousness, the mind that would kill, the mind of harming, and deciding against to go with another way in your mind. Now, you know, of course, so that's the level we're talking about, the entrance, the gateway level of taking refuge. That's the way it is. So later on, if you become a Mahayanist, you take a Bodhisattva vow. There's some are overriding vows. So there's levels, kind of. This is your entry level. And a nice place, way to practice. So then also, you're taking all refuge in the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, and that means you're not no longer going to Shiva or Vishnu or Zeus or Jehovah or Artemis, you know. And as for one thing, Buddha is not a god, and so that's sort of a break of your refuge anyway, because you're gods are not viewed as enlightened. We want to enlighten teachers. And so it's a major decision for a Westerner to drop monotheism. And gods are sometimes used, we're not saying gods don't exist. Sometimes they're used, or they do exist, either one. Some they've been used for the support of your Dharma practice. Sometimes we'll use them in a protective functionality. Bringing, and there's a whole pantheon of recognized gods and goddesses in the Tibetan world, in the Indian world, in the Chinese world. And, this is where we're committing. This is the way we're going. We're choosing. We're not being a dabbler anymore. You know, we're making a commitment. And then, so that's the second, the first. First is Buddha. And then,
I just have a clarification question, or maybe it's not even necessary, but I just want to make sure that people understand what you're talking about is, if you're a Christian and you believe in that God or in Jesus, Blessed Virgin Mary, etc., if you go for refuge, you are no longer looking to Jesus, for instance,
right,
to be your savior.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I know it's hard to know because we're merging East and West exactly. You know, it's not that you wouldn't respect Jesus, you know, and, you know, maybe you could call upon Jesus to find your keys. But
I see him as a bodhisattva. I know a lot of Christians kind of have an image of God that's more like, you know, there's not actually like an exact figure there. Like,
well, this gets into wrong views, mm-hmm. you know. So, this is a really painful term to hear. When I first heard it, I thought, I'm getting into a cult here. But, I wasn't getting into a cult. Dharma is not a cult. So, but the thing is, that's the next thing, that you're following the Buddha way. And the Buddha way, there is no universal benevolent force in the universe. So we have individual karma and individual mind streams. So a lot of people merge Hinduism and Buddhism in their minds. And I'm not telling anybody else what to do. I'm just saying, and from the traditional Buddhist way that I was taught, you're saying, I want to learn the Buddha way, and I want to follow that way of viewing my life and phenomena around me, things around me. So, saying people have misconceptions that, for example, Dharmakaya is a universal, like the Akashic record in New Age philosophy, like a universal energy field that we're all part of, and we're all connected by our actions and our by cause and effect, and we're all connected to each other in that way, but it's not like at the end of our life, all rivers are flowing into one big ocean, and we'll all be unified into one big Brahmic Godhead or Mother Goddess. You know, nothing like that in Dharma. It's different. So we can't go into all that in Buddhist philosophy at this point. You'd know that better than I would, but in terms of the subtleties of it. But it's something that's what's beautiful. Again, you learn over time. You decide this is the way I want to go, and you pursue, and you learn more and more. How is this? We try to think, well, I assume things are like this, but that's based on my background in a different culture, a different way. And is this really the way it is in Dharma? I had a lot of assumptions that I carried over from New Age things when I came into Dharma. And I've had to examine those over time. Surprising people, you know, I was really surprised. That's it. And also, you want to, embrace the Buddhist viewpoints, and then you want to stop relying on negative friends, you know, people who have really, for example, they harm, intentionally harm living beings and so forth, and have hate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hate is out. it's not gonna fly, you know. So you may have to step back from some relationships in your life. We're not in a Buddhist culture, so it's not. I'm not saying you have to give up all your marriage and all your friends and this kind of thing because they aren't Buddhist. Not like that. But you don't want somebody intensely negative in your life anyway, right? So it may be you have to create some distance there. So that's another part of the vow is not because you don't want to be, especially in the beginning. You don't want to be led astray by negative people, right? And another thing is, and this may sound trivial, but it's not really, is images of the Buddha, art, and then Buddhist texts and so forth, you treat them with respect from here on out. And respect for us means you don't put them on the floor because you might step on them. It's dirty on the floor. You know, you keep your books in a safe, higher location, and your images of the Buddha, you just be careful, take care with them, do what you can to treat them respectfully. And it's a little hard because we're flooded. If you start being a Buddhist, you'll see all these magazines come in. And so many images, and people of the past had no access to, you know, this hundreds and hundreds of images of Buddha and teachers and all that. But think about it, and think about it in social media also. There's a lot of people don't know exactly, you know, what to put on social media and how to treat it respectfully and so forth. So that's basically it.
This is actually a really helpful piece of it for me. You know, the thing about treating images with respect, you know, treating robes with respect and things like that, I feel like in our culture, I mean, I grew up Christian. People put the Bible on the ground, or they sit on the Bible, or, you know, rest their feet on the Bible. And, you know, it's just,
really,
yeah. Really? After I became Buddhist, I was like, I'm going to pick that Bible up for you.
I wouldn't put the Bible on the ground. I wouldn't put the Bible on the ground or the Upanishads.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
It's just crazy.
I think there's like a language of respect that I found in Asian cultures that I hadn't really seen here of how you treat something sacred. And I just want to give a shout out for everything you just mentioned, that I found it really helpful to actually do that as a way of cultivating, you know, you could say mindfulness, but really like mindfulness in a traditional sense of like remembering, you know, the value of these things.
Well, you know, I had an experience like that again with one of my teachers was in my apartment one time. And I had on the, like one of these cords are called protection cord. Lamas give them to you as a little blessing. On the end of it was a picture of one of my lamas, right? And I slept in the basement, and I put my lama and his wife in the in my room. And when they left, I found my little thing that I had sitting on a table, like normal jewelry, hung up on a hook on the wall. You know, the image of a teacher or whatever, like a place of respect, not junked in, clunked in with costume jewelry. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, you know, it's up to the individual. It's not like the thing is to get is there's not no God looking at you. It's not a theistic religion. So there's nobody examining and looking in your drawers to see, you know, it's whatever. It's really what's meaningful to you. But if you're in a Dharma center, you don't want to put your book on the floor for sure. If you find if for you, the floor is the most exalted and beautiful place in your house, maybe you can put your book on the floor. But the point is respect, you know?
Yeah, thank you. And just to clarify,
so it's really,
I think part of what I was hearing in your previous discussion was ways of respecting the Buddha, you know, not taking other gods as your refuge, ways of respecting the Dharma, not taking other belief systems as your refuge. And then when you're talking about, you know, not having intensely negative friends, as sort of like a way of respecting the Sangha. Am I correct in hearing that in what you said?
Well, yes. And why respect? You know, the Buddha doesn't care if you respect him or not, if you throw his image on the floor or you say, you know, F you, Buddha. you know, there's no guy there. who's judging. And this is something I think that our teacher is not judging us, psychically venturing into our bedroom and saying, oh, no. It's on you. I think, in a lot of traditions at the beginning, they put everything out there as a, like they're out there, the Buddhas are out there. Amitabha's in his pure land in the Western paradise. And there is a tradition of that. It's beautiful. But in general Mahayana Buddhism, I think, and definitely in Vajrayana Buddhism, it's symbolic of your own, of the, each sentient being has as their fundamental nature this infinite, compassionate wisdom, always even, and always present. It never goes to the hospital. It's there with you at the hospital, but it doesn't have anything to repair. It can't be cut. It can't be harmed. It's like space in that way. And so isn't that wonderful? So we use through symbols and this feeling of respect and even devotion. It opens up this presence in our heart. It opens up these latent qualities that are hidden right now. And it doesn't matter. You can be bad. You could be a bad person up till now. You could have killed people. It doesn't matter. You still have Buddha nature. Don't worry. Don't think you're not good enough to be a Buddha. It just, from that day forward, you make a vow, I'm not going to harm any sentient beings. And then you can build on that later when you're ready. I want to help sentient beings. I care about all sentient beings equally. Vast spaces, billions and billions of sentient beings. I care about all of them. I'm going to help all of them. That kind of bodhisattva intention. But we start with this basic, this is what I'm doing with this life. I'm going to take refuge. This is the path I'm choosing. And it means, for me, it meant focusing, because I had ADD when pretty bad, as I still do, but it's better. And so there was a tendency, me, myself, and my family members, I would say, not all of them, some of them, to want to do everything, all the world. My mom, I'm not really criticizing, it sounds like I am, but she was really liked theosophical literature. It was like spiritual approaches that try to blend from many, many different religions and hidden spiritual traditions into one and try to find the truths central to all of them. There's nothing, that's beautiful. There's nothing wrong with that. So, but I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to awakening, enlightenment. That sounds, whatever that is, man. And whatever he's got, I want it. I want to see what I can do. And it was kind of like some people do drugs that way. They want to know, what is LSD like? Will I find some great other dimension that I, whatever, they call it. But I wanted to find an intact spiritual tradition with real masters alive now and go deeper, deeper, deeper for as long as I can. And I'm so far from the end of that. Whatever, there is, I don't think there is no end to that, but if there is, I'm sure not there.
You're not alone.
I think so.
I find there's just so many like beautiful things in what you're saying. I just want to piggyback on what you said, that that ultimately the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that we're taking refuge in are kind of reflections of what's already within ourselves. I think sometimes, like I know from my mom, when I became a Buddhist and I would like bow down to things, that really freaked her out. And, but when I explained to her that what you're bowing down to isn't like a statue, it's a reflection of our own true nature, because we forget. She felt a lot better about that. So I just want to underscore what you were saying, and just add my own two cents that, I think it's for me, coming from a Christian background, I took refuge as though I was, you know, accepting Jesus as my Lord and Savior. And I think they're actually pretty different. Well, I guess it depends on how you take Jesus as your Lord and Savior. But, you know, for me, taking refuge was like a commitment to the sacred within myself and the sacred within everybody, as opposed to, you know, you've said this a couple of times, but I just want to underscore it. You know, I'm trying to get on Buddha's good side, or I'm trying to do the right thing so, you know, I don't get sent to a bad next life or something. It's a very different orientation. And that respect and the bowing or prostration is actually, I think, really helpful.
You're touching on something here, touching on two points that come out of that. One is Asian society, where people may take refuge, and they warn you against this in the Buddhist teachings, you know, take refuge as a way to get a better rebirth, that kind of thing. But that's just a rebirth in cyclic existence. That's not any kind of transcendent phenomena there at all. So that's, they'd warn you against that in the standard talk. But if for Westerners, there's also what I touched upon is maybe a sense of low self-esteem or being inherently dirty or impure, and needing Buddhism to sort of wash you clean or something like that. I don't know. And that is uniquely, you know, some Western cultures have this, and maybe it's spreading around the world with the internet, this self-esteem idea, not being polluted and so forth. Now, we do have, you know, in order to, we need to find our inherent purity somehow. And there are confession and purification ceremonies probably in every Buddhist tradition, for certainly in all the Mahayana traditions. So I'm not saying we never done anything wrong and we can't do any wrong, or, you know, I think you get that. It's not like that, but this inherent sense of lackingness, not being good enough is not there in Buddhism. And so we have unique challenges, and people who work with Westerners are trying to detect that. It's so ingrained that we may not even know we have it. And this is where working with a teacher or teachers is helpful, because they can help you. They may, or if they can pick up on it, which they will eventually if you hang out with them enough, and this is where hanging out in person is good, ideally. They can see that in you, it's such a habit that you don't even know you have it. It's so invisible, self-invisible. So when you get a teacher, and I'm not talking about a grand guru necessarily, you know, the way you're really going all in on it, but when you're just relating to normal Dharma teachers at any Dharma center, they may pick up on something like that. It's important not to be defensive. We have a habit of being defensive and covering and stuff. And so let's open ourselves a little bit and listen. Oh, that I haven't heard that about myself before. Huh. Now I'm going to reflect on that and not just automatically come back with something that is like, no. It's not like that, you know. Because that's what teachers are for, really. You can read books. And people say, oh, I can learn all from reading books or watching videos. And that's really, really good to read books and watch videos. But then you're closed off. You're not opening yourself to having a trusting relationship with a spiritual friend who can say, you know, honestly, your mind, I'm seeing here that you really haven't accepted impermanence, for example, you know. I'm sorry for what your loss, but there's something more here where the fundamentally, either there's really an you really think that things are permanent, you know, or that suffering is not inherent in life, you know. So, yeah, and you haven't turned your mind to the Dharma. So gradually, slowly, you know, after we become Buddhists or before, we're turning our minds to really believing in permanence, getting it, and really believing in suffering, it's like an existence, perhaps in karma, and so forth. So, and that word is renunciation, you know. It's just not maybe not the perfect word in English, but it means not caring so much about all this day-to-day up and down and all the thoughts in our head and the drama in our lives and all that stuff, beginning to care about what's going to go on after I'm dead, you know, embarking on this project to create a beautiful mind stream at the very minimum, you know, very beautiful mind, pure, clean, clear, open. And that thread will continue. So that big project supersedes all the little disasters in our lives. And it doesn't. So then if you die tomorrow, you can make that intention as you're going out, you know. Wait a minute. Think about Buddha. Think about, you know, your teachers and so forth. And that will go on.